Let's come back to this country now, where healthcare workers can reassure themselves with a grim joke. It's what you say if you work in the healthcare industry and there's a recession. Not to worry. People will always get sick. The healthcare industry was strong until recently, adding jobs as other industries cut back. Now there's growing evidence that the hospital industry is not immune. Kurt Nickisch reports from member station WBUR in Boston.
Steve Tringali runs a national healthcare consulting firm in Boston. In his 30 years in the business, he's never seen anything like this.
The recession is clearly hitting hospitals harder this time than it has in the past. The factors which are driving the overall economic downturn have conspired in some ways to almost set up a perfect storm for hospitals.
He says there are four main factors contributing to this storm. First, state budgets are tightening, so critical reimbursements to hospitals are shrinking. Second, as the economy weakens, people are losing their jobs and employer health insurance. Third, people are putting off medical care when they can.
It's been tough on the kids. I can't, you know, throw a ball to them anymore. I can't bend down to pick it up.
Wally Glendie has a bad knee, and he's up for replacement surgery, but he says he can't afford the copays and deductible.
It's just the wrong time to spend money. I mean, it is. If it was better, absolutely, but it's not the time to play around. Not at all. No.
Karen Nelson with the Massachusetts Hospital Association says there's another reason people like Glendie are putting off medical care.
Because the economy is so lousy, patients are deferring elective procedures. They're afraid to leave their job, to be out for 2 or 3 weeks, and then to come back and find a pink slip.
It's not only elective procedures that are down. A recent survey from the American Hospital Association says two-thirds of hospitals are seeing lower patient admissions overall. And this is at a time when they were counting on an older population needing more care. At Tufts Medical Center in Boston, this is all made worse by the fourth and final factor in the storm, the credit crunch. It's harder to get money to build a new wing or buy better equipment. Tufts Medical Center CEO Ellen Zane says the sliding stock market has also hit the hospital's endowment, which funds medical research.
When there are no gains, it's hard to support it. And it means that the clinical part of our enterprise has to, what I always say, is speed up the treadmill.
That means asking employees to do more, even while Tufts cuts back on hiring. Zane has put expansion plans on hold. She's also urging doctors to cut back on travel for their medical research. Changes like these are becoming common at hospitals across the country. Some are even laying off workers, including the venerable Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Healthcare consultant Steve Tringali says medical campuses are going to come out of this recession in worse financial and physical shape.
Hospitals need, you know, new heating systems, new chillers. ORs need to be rehabbed. Buildings need to be maintained, things like that.
Tringali says he thinks most hospitals will find ways to save money without cutting quality of care.
You know, the longer this recession goes, the higher the risk that that starts to become an issue. I don't think it's there right now.
Hospitals could get a helping hand from the incoming Obama administration. The president-elect's transition team says an economic stimulus package might include a boost to federal Medicaid dollars. That's giving hospitals some hope in what otherwise appears to be a weak, bleak 2009. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
The U.S. Army is investigating a cluster of suicides in the Houston recruiting battalion. Five soldiers there have taken their own lives since 2001. Across the country, in fact, 17 Army recruiters have committed suicide during the same period. Recruiting is considered one of the most stressful jobs in the military, and NPR's John McChesney explains why.
Back in March of 2007, Aaron Anderson locked himself in the cab of his Ford 150 pickup, called home to say he was going to kill himself. He shot up the dashboard radio and then put a bullet in his head. He'd threatened suicide 5 months earlier, and his father, Bob Anderson, reported him to the military.
I don't know if that was the right thing to do, but I called a major and told him that, you know, his girlfriend had said he'd threatened to commit suicide, and she told me that, you know, he was going through night terrors and a bunch of other things, and, you know, he'd get up to go to work in the morning, and he'd tell his girlfriend that he was exhausted, and she'd say, well, yeah, you know, you've been jumping over the couch and hiding behind the chairs and stuff half the night like you're in battle, and he wouldn't even realize it in the morning.
Aaron had served two tours in Iraq. He was furious with his father for reporting him, saying his army career would be ended.
And I just simply told him that, well, Aaron, if you don't talk to me ever again, I can live with that. But if I didn't turn you in and something happened, I don't think I could live with that.
Robert Anderson says his son had trouble delivering the required two recruits a month, especially after his experience in Iraq.
How could you be over there and see some of the things that he saw and dealt with and try to hire people to go over there and do that?
Chris Rodriguez, a friend who worked with Aaron as a recruiter, says no one wanted to lie, but the pressure on recruiters is intense during wartime.
A soldier doesn't want to get down and really beg a person to join the Army, but I think often at times these recruiters and myself, we felt like we were begging them and trying to do anything just to convince them to give it a try like we had. We often sat in the recruiting station, sometimes really late, and talked about how we'd rather be in Iraq than recruiting.
Aaron Anderson was diagnosed with PTSD and depression and returned to recruiting duty. His unit was advised to keep an eye on him, and 5 months later, he took his life. On August 9th of this year, Staff Sergeant Larry Flores, also an Iraq veteran, hanged himself in his garage with an extension cord. Fellow recruiters told the Houston Chronicle that a week earlier, Flores had been yelled at and threatened with firing for failing to meet the goal of two recruits each month. He was also having trouble with his wife. 2 weeks later, Sergeant First Class Patrick Henderson, also an Iraq veteran in the same recruiting company with Flores, hanged himself in the garage behind his home. Like Aaron Anderson, Patrick had earlier called his wife Amanda from his pickup, saying he was going to kill himself.
Crazed, hysterical, couldn't, you know, he was crying and screaming. And I kept asking him, what's wrong? And he goes, I can't deal with it anymore. I just can't deal with it anymore. He said, I got the shotgun.
Amanda and her friend talked Patrick down that time. She says the next morning he was delusional and imagined he was back in Iraq. He was sent off to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio for evaluation, then returned to his outfit, but relieved from recruiting duty. Amanda, herself a recruiter in the same battalion, says she remained terrified.
He kept telling me that, no, he's not going to do it. No, he's not going to do it. And he tried to convince me, but I knew in the back of my head, deep down, that if you were going to try it once, you were definitely going to do it again. So I knew something was wrong.
There's been a fourth suicide in the Houston Battalion during this same time period involving another combat veteran. No other details are available. The Army says a fifth reported suicide in Houston was not a recruiter. I stopped by the Houston Battalion's headquarters and was escorted inside, where I was told there was an investigation underway and no one could talk to me. As I walked outside, the U.S. Army Recruiting Command at Fort Knox in Kentucky called my cell phone to tell me a general had been appointed to look into the matter. Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn called for that investigation.
I asked for an independent investigation. This is not what I'd call an independent investigation, but it's a step in the right direction. And my hope is after this command investigation that we can see what that produces, and then we'll, I hope, hold hearings.
One of the questions the senator wants answered is whether it's wise to order combat veterans to take recruiting jobs. Most of them don't volunteer. James Larson is a retired senior policy analyst for the Army Recruiting Command.
I believe, short of being shot at and you know, risking your life, that recruiting is probably the toughest job in the Army.
Larson says a few years ago, a study commissioned by the Army looked at the level of stress hormones in recruiters.
Recruiters have the highest stress levels of any occupation in the United States. Policemen, firemen, special operations, you know, spies, you name it. Head and shoulders, recruiters have the highest stress levels of anybody.
Whether or not recruiters have the highest stress level, there's little doubt that they're under extraordinary pressure to sell the Army to a small number of reluctant consumers. Add to that the marital stress brought on by 12 to 14-hour workdays, the isolation of being stationed in small towns far from a base, and, in the Houston Battalion's case, alleged abusive treatment of those who didn't produce their quota. And you have a potentially toxic cocktail. Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn.
The other part of this that was troubling was the idea that there was pressure, suggestion there was pressure being put down the chain of command to keep this quiet.
Senator Cornyn wants to know if the Houston Battalion's problems are an isolated case or whether recruiter stress patterns are similar in other places. Sergeant Henderson's wife, Amanda, believes the problems are widespread and that the Houston Battalion in particular ignored all the danger signals.
It needed to be looked at heavily whenever the first one taken his life, not wait until the fifth one had taken his life. Because the fifth one was my husband.
John McChesney, NPR News.
Whatever the cost may have been, we can tell you that all the military services, the Army, Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines, met their recruiting targets in 2008. The U.S. Army signed up just over 80,000 recruits. Last April, NPR reported that the Army was accepting more recruits without high school diplomas in order to meet its goals. Early in the decade, over 90% of new recruits had diplomas, but by 2007, the figure had dipped to 79%. We can tell you the figure improved slightly in the past year.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Imagine if your hands shook so badly that you couldn't even lift a glass of water. Well, that's what life is like for millions of Americans who suffer from essential tremor disorder. The condition can be devastating if you're a musician. And that was almost the case for guitarist Richard Crandall. The musician found a way to continue composing and performing, as Joel Rose reports.
Richard Crandall started playing guitar when he was a kid, but he didn't really take it seriously until the late 1960s when he heard guitarist John Fahey. For Crandall, it was a revelation.
With an acoustic guitar, you could create a whole orchestra. In other words, I could play these solo pieces that sounded fine just the way they were.
In the early 1970s, Crandall left his job and his marriage in Buffalo, New York. He moved to the West Coast and started writing songs of his own. Crandall settled down in Eugene, Oregon, and eventually opened for Fahey. Crandall's occasional roommate, Mark Zorn, says his friend's guitar rarely left his hands.
He was always practicing. It was just a joy to have music in the house like that.
Crandall went on to record half a dozen albums. One of his tunes was even recorded by another of his idols, Leo Kottke. But Crandall never achieved Kottke's level of fame. And these days, the guitar seems to cause him more frustration than joy.
If my life depended on it and I had to play the dance section of Be Good or Be Gone, this is how it would come out. I can't play it.
Richard Crandall was diagnosed 6 years ago with essential tremor disorder. An estimated 10 million Americans live with the condition, which affects fine motor coordination. In Crandall's case, his hands shake when he tries to write, use a computer, or play difficult passages on the guitar. It was around this time that Crandall got a job offer. A local concert promoter asked Crandall to drive a tour bus for Afro-pop star Thomas Mopfumo and his band. But Crandall had never driven a bus before.
I was petrified, because I was responsible for the lives of 14 Africans. I was not mechanical. I had a terrible sense of direction, but they trusted me.
Crandall successfully piloted the tour bus from Oregon to Alabama and back, then parked it in front of his apartment.
They had totally cleaned out the bus. I looked under one of the seats, and I found this imbira, and I said, oh, what's this?
The imbira is a traditional thumb piano from Africa. Crandall's comes from Zimbabwe. It's a flat piece of wood that he holds in his hands, with a row of metal strips across the top that he plays with his thumbs. To his surprise, Crandall discovered that his hands don't shake when he plays it.
I didn't say, oh, I've got essential tremor, I better start playing the imbira. I just like the sound of it.
Crandall taught himself how to tune and play the imbira. From the beginning, he says he wasn't trying to play Shona music from Zimbabwe. Still, he was criticized, not by the musicians in Thomas Mapfumo's band, but by other Americans.
There are little pockets of imbira players around the country who play traditional Shona music, and they sort of look down on you if you change the instrument around or do anything else. But the guys in Thomas's band, they loved what I was doing. They said, Richard, play us a new song.
Before long, Crandall was performing his new songs in public. Even his longtime friend Mark Zorn was surprised by how quickly Crandall adapted to the imbira.
I didn't take it seriously until I was wandering around the Saturday market and I heard these shimmering notes, which could only have been from the imbira. As music does, it just turned my head right away and I moved toward the source, and there was Richard.
Crandall's songs also caught the ear of Mark Zorn's younger brother, the MacArthur Genius Grant-winning saxophonist, composer, and producer John Zorn, who runs a record label and a club in New York City. In 2004, Zorn brought Crandall to the East Coast to record, and he recruited Brazilian-born Ciro Baptista to join Crandall in the studio. The percussionist says he was impressed by Crandall's sense of restraint.
He plays enough, not more than should be. It's great because he plays living space. I could play in the betweens with him. The fact that he played guitar before is a plus for him because he has a harmonic concept of the instrument. And the plus, he have amazing rhythm.
Baptista and Crandall made two records together. They've gotten strong reviews and even made a few critics' top 10 lists.
I'm grateful to have my little imbira. It turns out that I've gotten more attention on that than I ever got on the guitar.
That started to change in the last few years as more of Crandall's guitar music has been released on CD for the first time. Crandall says it's bittersweet to read glowing reviews of his early work.
I used to not think I was quite good enough, or I didn't realize I had how special what I was doing was. You know, I just kind of took it for granted. So now I've got this other gift, you know, of the imbira and being able to do something with that.
Crandall isn't taking his second act for granted. He's planning to record a benefit album for the Essential Tremor Foundation, and he has even bigger plans.
My mission at this point is to calm the world with this music because it seems to be so soothing. And I'd love to play for the inauguration if anybody out there is listening.
And if anyone is going to need some soothing music, Crandall figures it's President-elect Barack Obama. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
You can hear a cross-section of Crandall's music, both on guitar and imbira, at nprmusic.org.
Back now with Day to Day. Chances are you've seen a blind person accompanied by a guide dog before, but what about a guide horse, or a service parrot, or a monkey trained to help an agoraphobic? These are the animals Rebecca Skloot wrote about in a piece titled Creature Comforts. It will appear in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Rebecca joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This piece starts out with a really wonderful little vignette. Children are out trick-or-treating and they see a woman and she's accompanied by a black and white adorable miniature horse. And one of the kids says to her, cool costume. But as you write, the woman is blind. The horse is not a costume. It is with her every day to help guide her. Rebecca, why have a guide miniature horse instead of a dog?
There are a lot of reasons for it. And the first reason that miniature horse users give is lifespan. Horses tend to live and work into their 30s, whereas a guide dog will work probably 6 to 8 years total. They're usually not placed with a blind person until they're around 2, and they usually retire around anywhere between 8 and 10. So what that means is that in the life of a blind person, they can go through, you know, many dogs, and some guide dogs just don't work out. But in addition to the longer lifespan, there's also they're herd animals, so they sort of naturally work really well with other people because they're aware of sort of moving in synchronicity with another creature. And they also have incredibly good vision. They see 360 degrees and are actually aware of their surroundings in a way that dogs aren't always, because they're prey animals as opposed to predators. So they're very aware of what goes on above them, such as, you know, a construction rope or something like that. They might actually notice that before a dog would.
In this piece, you write about a man named Jim Eggers, and he has bipolar disorder with psychotic tendencies. Could you tell us about his service animal? Her name is Sadie.
Yeah, Sadie is an African gray parrot. So she's a pretty small parrot. And she rides around on his back in a backpack, a bright purple backpack that he's had built around a cage. So she's in a cage on his back, and he is pretty severely bipolar, and he has these psychotic tendencies, and he is often threatening to attack people, or actually attacked people in the past. And what Sadie does is she rides around his back, and she can actually sense when he's starting to get upset before he realizes it's even happening. And she'll say, it's okay, Jim. Calm down, Jim. I'm here, Jim. You're all right, Jim. And she'll just do this in a loop, and she'll talk him down.
According to the Americans with Disabilities Act, service animals are allowed to go wherever their human owners are. But as you write, that's been causing some problems. What's been happening there?
People are just used to dogs. They don't associate parrots, horses, monkeys, ferrets, you know, ducks, goats with service animals. So I think the reaction of a lot of business owners and the general public is often one of suspicion that you're sort of making it up.
It sounds as if some people are just not exactly comfortable with animals being in their businesses. But as you point out, there are also some concerns about health that might be legitimate. You talk about a certain kind of monkey that is known to carry certain types of diseases. I mean, it sounds like there might be some potential problems here.
Pretty much everyone I talked to said horses, birds, you know, ferrets, they don't pose any more of a health risk than dogs and cats do. Monkeys can be a different story, in part because some breeds of monkeys carry viruses that can be deadly to humans. So they carry it, particularly herpes B, which is a virus that has a very minimal effect on the monkey, sort of like cold sores with us. But if a human gets it, it's over 70% fatal, and there's nothing you can really do about it. So this is a fairly, you know, there's good reason to be concerned about that. But the most commonly used monkey for service animals is a capuchin monkey. They're the small sort of organ grinder monkeys. And they've been working with quadriplegics since the early 80s. And, you know, they do things like open bottles and, you know, put food in the microwave and scratch itches. I mean, they're incredible service animals. And they aren't a strain that's usually that carries this sort of virus.
Rebecca, you spent a lot of time with these people and the animals that have been helping them. Is there one moment that stands out to you for something that just was really surprising in terms of what these animals were capable of doing?
Yeah, there were several. And I actually think that the moment that I started the story with, where Anne and her guide miniature horse Panda or walking around their neighborhood was really, I think, the most striking for me. You know, because I could sort of envision how a horse could help guide a person. But the level at which Panda guides her is really amazing. She, you know, in just a few blocks, I saw her maneuver Anne around things that I, as a person who's sighted, wouldn't have even sort of thought of, like, you know, a drainage ditch in the ground. And one of the things that was sort of striking to me was her use of her hooves. And this is something that Anne sort of pointed out to me later and said, you know, this was kind of a perk that we didn't expect, that you can hear her hooves when she walks. Sort of sounds like someone who's walking in clogs. And she'll walk up to a sidewalk. And as they're walking along, she'll take her hoof and she'll just kind of go, and she'll tap the sidewalk so that Anne knows, oh, here's a step up. At one point, Anne has the horse find her the button to cross, to walk across the street, the walk signal button. She walks up to a pole and she says, find the button. And Panda, you know, trotted up to the pole and tapped at the base of the pole. So Anne knew that they were now at the pole. And you can hear all these different tones with Panda's hooves. And it was this little moment where I thought, you know, I sort of registered, wow, this is something that a dog absolutely couldn't do. You can hear when you're on wood. You can hear when you're on leaves. You can hear a pitch change in any terrain that you're on, which added this whole element to working with this horse that, you know, Anne had never experienced with a dog. So that was one moment where I sort of, you know, that wasn't necessarily an ability that the horse had. It was just something that Panda's trainer, you know, in the process of training her, they realized, hey, this is something that, you know, we can really work with. And they sort of took advantage of it.
Rebecca Skloot's piece, Creature Comforts, will appear in the Sunday New York Times Magazine. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to see photographs of Panda the horse, Sadie the parrot, and a service monkey named Richard, go to our blog. It's npr.org/daydreaming. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
As longtime listeners know, this program works to help you find books that slip under the radar. Librarian Nancy Pearl gave us a pile of them yesterday, and this morning we have one more. It's a book from this past year by Elizabeth McCracken called An Exact Replica of a Figment of My Imagination. NPR's Lynn Neary describes it as a beautifully written book about McCracken's first child, who was stillborn. Lynn visited McCracken and her family and has the story.
A fiction writer, Elizabeth McCracken thought she would never write a memoir.
And I probably especially had some scorn for memoirs that were about the worst thing that ever happened to you. Then something really, really bad happened to me, and I realized that I needed to write about it.
As McCracken talks, her two-week-old daughter Matilda sleeps in her arms, and as newborns are wont to do, wakes up every now and then.
Ooh. Ooh. Oh, yes. The world. Oh, Matilda. Hard to be a baby. It's very difficult work sometimes.
Matilda is McCracken's third child with her husband, Edward Carey. Their first died inside McCracken's womb in April 2006. McCracken and Carey are very clear on the number of children they've had. If a stranger asks on the street or in a store, they might say, we have two. But to them, it is unquestionably three. In large part, it was the need to hold on to the reality of their firstborn that led McCracken to write the book. It poured out of her in several weeks after the birth of their son, Gus, a time of conflicting and complex emotions.
I was worried about my grief for the first child somehow interfering with my love for Gus. But I was also really worried about the other, that somehow it was disloyal to my first child to pretend that now everything was all right, that this new and fantastic baby somehow meant that first death was not as deep a sorrow as it was.
McCracken and Carey, who is also a writer, were living in France during her first pregnancy. They had settled in an old farmhouse near Bordeaux, working on their writing and getting ready for the next stage of their life to begin. But just before the baby was due, it became clear that something had gone wrong. When a sonogram confirmed that the baby was dead, McCracken learned that she would still have to deliver her child, a delivery which was delayed for 36 hours so that doctors could do tests to find out what had caused the death.
The day delay was kind of amazing to me, but the worst thing had already happened. The fact that my child had died was the worst thing. And so I sort of thought, well, you know, if he has to be delivered, he has to be delivered, you know, and it did seem sort of like the last thing that I could do for him.
At one point, McCracken and Carrie left the hospital and went to a cafe, McCracken still looking heavily pregnant. Here, McCracken reads from that section of the book.
There was no oxygen in that little plaza in Bordeaux. Edward and I both felt it. I could not look anyone in the eye, lest they smile and ask me about my baby. This was a mistake, said Edward. We don't belong here. Meaning, out in the world. We'd escaped, but where could we go with me in my condition? Time had bent again. Time had developed a serious kink. Our old life, the one where we planned our existence around the son we were expecting, had ended, but our new life, the one where we tried to figure out how to live without him, couldn't start yet.
The baby who died had a name. During the pregnancy, McCracken and Carrie had been calling him Pudding. And in the end, Carrie says, they made that official.
You know, we had a couple of names that we were possibly going to call him, but he had only ever really been Pudding, and he would have stopped being Pudding, and he would have become something else had he lived, but he didn't. And so it seemed absolutely sensible that that was his name.
Pudding is what you put on the death certificate.
What his death certificate, what was on his little coffin, and that's who he'll always be.
After a summer spent in England, staying as busy as possible, McCracken and Carrie returned to the U.S., but first, they scattered Pudding's ashes on one of Carrie's favorite beaches on the Norfolk coast.
And that part of the world is sort of stamped now in our heads as a sort of sacred place. And we took Gus there this summer, and seeing him running around on the beach was just fantastic. And oh, Mr.
And there he is, on cue.
Come here.
And as Gus bursts into the room with the furious energy of a toddler, his father scoops him up into his arms and comforts him. Once settled down, the two sit on the floor reading books.
That's a dog, and what's that one?
Yeah.
That's right, it's a cat.
And looking at this beautiful boy, so full of life, one wonders, is he the exact replica of the figment of her imagination? Is he their happy ending? No, says McCracken. Gus is not an ending.
He's the start of his own story, and he is unconnected from this thing that happened before him. That's part of my story, but not part of his story. So it's not that I think that Gus is the exact replica, but maybe the book itself is. That I wrote the book trying, as I say, to get every single detail about this person whose face I never looked at while he was alive, and that I couldn't manage to give him a life, but I could write his biography.
But McCracken knows the biography will always be incomplete. The details of her firstborn's personality will always be, as she puts it, entirely imaginary.
I'm holding a 2.5-week-old in my lap who's snuffling and snorting, and I already have a much clearer idea of who she is from knowing her for 2.5 weeks. I think she looks like, when she wakes up, she looks like an old lady who's woken up for no reason in a discotheque. What? What's going on? Why are the lights so bright? What's that infernal racket?
Next summer, McCracken and Carrie will go back to the beach in Norfolk with Gus and his new sister. It seems, says Carrie, like the place where all three of their children are together. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Hospitals are supposed to be the place you go when you're sick, but many hospitals are sick themselves, victims of the bad economy. Late last year, the rating service Moody's dropped its assessment of bonds issued by nonprofit hospitals from stable to negative. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports on how the credit squeeze is taking its toll on nonprofit hospitals.
5-year-old Jane Sullivan sits cross-legged on a bed at St. John's Hospital in the middle-class suburb of Maplewood, Minnesota. She's still in her plaid school uniform. Her forehead is nearly hidden by white gauze.
Because I hurt my head, I slipped on a puddle of ice.
that fall resulted in a lot of blood.
It spilled on my jacket.
Jane's father, Joe, picked her up at school after the nurse called. The last thing he wanted to do was drive miles and miles looking for an emergency room. St. John's is 5 miles away.
This was not in Jane's plan today or my plan, so having an emergency room close is really important.
It's quiet now on a weekday morning, but things can get busy at night and on weekends. About 40,000 people a year come through this emergency department, including in the past couple of years, patients injured by a nearby tornado, a chemical spill, and a bridge collapse. Sometimes the 22 small, sparkling clean rooms aren't enough. About 5 hours a month, the hospital has to turn patients away. That's not good, says St. John's Chief Financial Officer, Bob Gill.
That's our job, to be in the community to serve the patients. So when we have to turn them away, it's a very uncomfortable feeling.
Which is why 3 years ago, the hospital began planning an extension.
The biggest thing was the emergency department, the fact that it was going on divert on a regular basis. And we were putting a lot of stress into the occupancy of the hospital.
So hospital officials made $68 million worth of plans. Among other things, they'd build a bigger, more sophisticated emergency department. They wanted more obstetrics rooms because sometimes the obstetrics department has to send women in labor to a hospital 10 miles away. They'd finance it the way many nonprofit hospitals finance construction, by selling tax-free bonds. A few years ago, the interest rate they would have had to pay was an affordable 5.75%.
We had a viable project. We had something that was going to meet the community's needs and, you know, enable us to provide comprehensive patient care services to our constituents.
But by the time the construction plans were finally ready a year ago, the economy was starting to tank. Investment banker David Johnson, who's not connected to St. John's, is an expert on hospital financing.
The hospital revenue bond market functioned supremely well up until August of 2007. At that time, we saw the first cracks in the performance.
The cracks started in some of those complicated funding structures Wall Street was pushing. Different kind of bonds than what St. John's wanted to offer. Those bonds were having problems because of how they were insured and because their interest rates periodically changed. And that scared buyers away from the routine fixed-rate type of bond St. John's wanted to offer, a type of bond that usually sold easily. Meanwhile, bondholders were trying to get rid of what they had. All that created a classic case of low demand and high supply. It didn't look good to Bob Gill at St. John's.
At that point in time, we realized that, whoa, wait a minute, this is not the time to be issuing bonds.
For St. John's Hospital, the 5.75% rate they were ready to pay rose to 8 or 9% by early spring of 2008 if they could sell the bonds. Each percentage point increase meant the hospital would have to pay an extra $680,000 a year.
So we really did a quick stop and a quick halt to the project, and since things have gotten worse in the credit markets and so on, from that point, we have pretty much put the project on a hold.
The market got even worse after St. John's made its decision. It used to be that in a typical week, $4 to $8 billion in hospital bonds were sold. But from mid-September to the end of October 2008, the hospital bond market essentially closed down, says investment banker David Johnson.
There were no sales.
None.
None.
It's since come back a little, he says, but it's still very erratic. According to a survey this fall by the American Hospital Association, more than half of American hospitals have postponed or canceled capital improvements. Johnson says the only silver lining is that the bond situation helps limit overbuilding and unnecessary spending for redundant technology. Losing the chance to improve St. John's Hospital frustrates CFO Bob Gill.
It was a big disappointment to all of us that we were put into a position where we could not do something that we knew was the right thing to do. It's hard. It's uncomfortable. But, you know, we have to do what we have to do, and common sense said don't do it, and we didn't.
Meanwhile, Gill has scraped together about a quarter of the money he had been after to do some modernization. And as for Jane Sullivan, who scraped her head, she got stitches put in and went home, her hospital wristband covered in the stickers the ER nurses gave her. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.